Good afternoon. Welcome to this session. What's the title again?
Algorithmic risk.
Algorithmic risk. I should remember that one. So hopefully with half a dozen of you in the room, we'll have half a dozen questions. So get them ready. So welcome this afternoon. We'd like to welcome our two speakers, Bassem and Kranthi. And just to introduce them first of all, so Bassem is a data analytics actuary at Deloitte Australia with a focus on enabling businesses to use analytics to realise the power of data. Prior to that, he worked in London as an independent risk analytics consultant to some of the largest European, Asian and Australian financial institutions, as well as holding a management position with Deloitte UK. His experience spans analytics, general insurance, counterparty credit risk modelling, derivatives pricing and futures trading. Outside of work, Bassem enjoys playing, watching and talking about football. Soccer over here, football where I come from. Kranthi is a senior data scientist within the analytics practice at Deloitte Australia with close to 7 years of experience. Prior to joining the Australian firm, he worked with the US and India Deloitte practices, leading teams and providing end-to-end solutions to complex business problems. He helped many organisations across multiple industries, such as insurance, fraud detection, retail, CNIP and public sector, uncover insights about their customers using data-driven analytics. Kranthi has published numerous publications and is a regular speaker in various analytics forums talking about artificial intelligence, deep learning and behavioural science. So we're in for an interesting session. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. So nice small groups. Hopefully we can keep it interactive. So the topic today is algorithmic risk, and what's a presentation about analytics without some buzzwords? So I thought I'll start with some of the most popular ones. So we got machine learning, we've got robotic process automation, we've got artificial intelligence, AI, that's a favourite of a lot of people, natural language processing, natural language generation as well if you want, we've got neural networks, and we've got deep learning. So a lot of the buzzwords that we often hear these days, a lot of these things that I've just mentioned are really underpinned by what's called an algorithm. An algorithm is basically a mathematical model that attempts to either describe, predict, or even prescribe a certain action. Like never before, algorithms are touching almost every part of our life these days. If you think about it, from the information you get shown on the internet, the ads that pop up on your screen, the movies you're recommended to watch, the products that Amazon might pop up in front of you, even the news you're shown, all these are driven by an algorithm beneath the surface. The jobs you'll be offered, maybe, whether your loan application gets approved or not, your insurance premium, even your medical treatment, and in the US, the judicial system even uses algorithms, and I'll touch on that later. Now, on top of all that, there's a sharp rise of machine-to-machine interaction, what's called the Internet of Things, and these as well are underpinned by an algorithm. So in the very not-too-distant future, your driverless car, in an emergency, deciding which way to turn and which way to veer, will be basically driven by an algorithm beneath the surface. So they are touching every part of our life. Just to kind of go through quickly the evolution of algorithms and for, you know, from the modelling that we're all familiar with to what's currently happening now with algorithms. So previously the classic kind of model had a smaller data set, you know, a data set you could probably dump into Excel or on your computer. These days we're using huge data sets, what's called big data, so that the data has exploded. Before it used to be organized and clean, and again maybe in a spreadsheet, in columns. Now we have things like unstructured data, so we can have photos, emails, all sorts of things that don't fit in a table. The sources of your data previously were usually internal from your own systems. Now we're using external data as well as internal data, so it gets a bit messier. The infrastructure. Previously we would use our own PC, your own desktop, with a dedicated server. Now we can use distributed computing, and things are done on the cloud. So it's getting a bit more complicated as well. The complexity of the modelling, we used to use familiar kind of statistical approaches that are easy to understand, intuitive. Now we're using what's called complex nested predictive techniques like neural networks, and these models are now self-learning. So they self-update and self-adapt. So the point I'm trying to make with this slide is that these things are really complex, and often people don't understand what they're doing, but they're touching every part of our life and they're making some very serious decisions about our life. So where can risks creep in an algorithm? I thought I'd show you kind of the steps involved in building an algorithm so we can better understand what to look out for and at which points risks may creep in. So the first stage is the input data. Now, you've got to be careful with your input data, because if your input data is biased in any way, then you're starting on the wrong foot completely. Definitely your model will be biased as well. I'll give you an example. Currently, they're trying to use algorithms. And by the way, just to fill you guys in, I'm going to be using some everyday kind of life examples, and my colleague Cranthy will dive into some insurance examples to better suit the actuaries. So currently, they're using algorithms for recruitment. Now, if you think about it, what an algorithm effectively is it's a model that looks at past data and tries to predict the future based on the past data. It learns from what happened in the past. If I'm basically trying to recruit a CEO and I look at past data and I predict of all my applicants who's going to be the most successful CEO, it's not surprising that maybe my model will be skewed towards male, because in the past it's been mainly males. Things are changing now, but the model will not take that into account, that change into account. So my past data, my historic data, is biased in a certain way, and my algorithm will be biased in the same way. So input data, you need to be careful at that stage before you even start modelling. Then you've got the algorithm design, obviously, that comes after. Do you guys know that in the US, in US mortgage models before the GFC, before the financial crisis, a lot of the models would not mathematically accept negative moves in house prices? That's the way it was designed. And as you can see, obviously that wasn't true. And, you know, major problems happened because the model design just wasn't right. Another thing about model design is that you've got to be careful what variables to use. So I'll give you another example. In a credit risk model, say for cars, so when you go buy a car and they offer you a loan, there's a model behind whether you get approved or not. If, for example, you use the type of car you're trying to buy as a variable, right? If you think about it, the more prestigious the car, the more likely that your credit rating is quite good. So there's a bit of correlation between the type of car you're going to go for to buy and your credit history, right? So if you think about it, if I go to buy a car and I get rejected for the loan, the salesman could say to me, hey, if you just go for a better car, you might actually make it, because that variable will show you as a better risk, so you may actually make it. So it's a subtle point, but you've got to be careful what variables to use in your model and how that's implemented. Then you've got the implementation and monitoring phase after you've built the model. And the issue there could be, one of the issues could be that if your model is not recalibrated or updated regularly, your model could become stale. So an example that we worked on at Deloitte is we were building, even an insurance example, we're building a claims triage model. It's basically that the model triages claims into buckets, whether they're, you know, based on severity, duration, complexity. And obviously then the more complex claims will get assigned to a claims manager, a more experienced claims manager. The model was built. It was running great. It was segmenting very nicely. And then as the years went on, the business's practices started to improve. They started to manage the claims a lot better. And then basically the model became very skewed towards the lower risk buckets, and it put a lot of the claims into the lower risk buckets simply because the business practice had changed. So that was an issue with not updating the model regularly and recalibrating regularly. So more generally as well, I think we need to remember that algorithms aren't perfect. Models aren't perfect, as we all know. If you think about it, inherently, a model or a computer, if you break it right down, it's all ones and zeros, right? Black and white, black and white. But the real world is hardly ever black and white. The real world's almost always grey. So to try to use a black and white model and to falsely assume that it's going to perfectly represent the grey world we live in is naive. In the real world, you have infinite variables that you can't really fit in a model. Another point as well is that if you think about it, models are good at interpolating, but they're not so great at extrapolating. If something new happens, the model, like the GFC, for example, negative house prices, house growth prices, the model won't be able to deal with that. Models learn from the past, as we said, so more often than not, your model will reconfirm your previous bias. It will just basically confirm it and solidify it. So, some real kind of stories that have happened recently in the media. Because these models are now becoming kind of mysterious black boxes of decision making, they're vulnerable to risk. And that's what we're calling here in this presentation algorithmic risk. Now, the scary thing about this algorithmic risk is that you may not even know that it exists. You may be thinking the model's running fine, everything's going great, until, you know, everything goes wrong and you're in the front pages of the paper. So a few examples are, have you guys heard of the Tay tweets? So Microsoft created an artificial intelligence chatbot that was meant to tweet. So they put it on Twitter, let it loose, and it started to tweet and basically converse with Twitter users. After, I think, a few hours, basically the tweet started to become very racist, very inappropriate, and basically had to shut it down, pull it, and delete all the tweets. I find that very interesting because if you think about it, how did this artificial intelligence chatbot learn to be racist? From us, unfortunately. So it says a lot about humanity and what we're like because we're the ones who taught it. But that's kind of an example of very naively implementing an algorithm and throwing it into the public and things going wrong. Another example was, have you heard of the Google flu trends? So Google thought, we got a lot of data, we got a lot of search data. People use our search engines often. So why don't we try to use what people search to basically predict flu epidemics before they start? Great idea. They ran the model. It was an epic failure. The reason is, a few reasons. The algorithm was actually quite vulnerable to overfitting. So what they did was they thought, instead of just very simply looking at people searching for flu or I feel sick, let's go, you know, more complex than that. Let's look at correlated searches with a flu. So it doesn't have to be the flu, but something that correlates with the flu season. So what do people search during the flu season? And we'll do that. Now, what they didn't realize is that during the flu season, people are searching things like high school basketball. And you know, the basketball season was on at the same time. So the model had a tendency to overfit to those terms that are unrelated to the flu. Another issue with the Google flu trends is that what they didn't realize is after they implemented the model, the search behavior of people changed. So what Google introduced after they implemented this model was the whole suggested search feature. You know, when you start typing and it suggests for you the search. So they implemented that after the model. And on top of that, they added some health kind of add-ons to help people, you know, search for health-related topics. Obviously, that skewed the data significantly, and it basically threw off the model. So that's kind of another example of an algorithm gone wrong. Closer to home, the Centrelink's automated income matching system. I'm sure we're all familiar with that. Again, bad model design, where it basically looked at income and averaged it across 26 fortnightly reporting periods and didn't consider the actual period where the income was earned and, again, hit the pages of the newspaper. Another one that you may have heard of, Google Face Detection, couldn't tell the difference between black people and gorillas. It couldn't distinguish. Again, another example of a bad algorithm that shouldn't have been released out in the public. And there are numerous examples. Like, for example, the 2016 US elections. Algorithms were blamed for basically filtering people's news, the news that you get exposed to sway your opinion. During the Brexit referendum in 2016, algorithms were blamed for a flash crash of the Great British Pound. I think it dropped like 6% in 2 minutes. Because of algorithmic trading and algorithms running wild in the markets. And according to recent studies, as I mentioned, online ads for higher paying jobs were shown more to men than to women. Again, back to the point where I was talking about the historical data. And I guess what I want us to think about is what other examples are currently out there that we're not aware of. Where's the next scandal going to hit, you know, related to these algorithms and the algorithmic risks that we run? Now, the regulators have made it very clear recently. So APRA, ASIC, the ACCC, they've made it very clear that firms are responsible for their algorithms. So as ASIC said, the algorithm ate my homework can't be an excuse that you use. You are responsible for the behavior of your algorithm. So firms need to take this seriously and really think about how they manage this algorithmic risk. I'm not saying the algorithms are bad and we should chuck them out the window, but to fully harness the power of an algorithm, you need a robust governance framework, risk governance framework, around it. You need to make sure that the decisions the algorithm is making are consistent with your corporate and social objectives. However, we can't manage this new category of algorithmic risk, because I believe that this category of algorithmic risk is going to be like all the traditional categories that we often hear about: credit risk, market risk, operational risk. This is going to be the new category of risk, algorithmic risk, that needs to be treated with the same seriousness. But you can't manage this new category of algorithmic risk with old techniques. The reason is that these are more complex, as I said, they're a lot more unpredictable. The proprietary nature as well of algorithms makes them harder to check. Firms aren't going to just release their algorithms for scrutiny. They're proprietary information. As I said, they're self-learning, they're nested, and there's a lack of standards and regulation. So that makes it all the more dangerous. Now, I think that actuaries are ideal to work in this space because we are technical enough to understand the algorithms, we're technical enough to unlock the black box, and at the same time have a very good understanding of risk and governance frameworks. So I think this is a space that we ideally should get into, and we at Deloitte are working in a model where actuaries, like myself, are working with data scientists, like Cranthi, and we find that model works very well, and we really complement each other's skill sets in order to attack this algorithmic risk issue. Now, just before I hand over to Cranthi, I just wanted to talk about an interesting kind of risk or aspect of this risk, which is algorithmic fairness. And this is something you may have read about in the media. I'll take a US example, because I think it's quite a good example, where they're, as I mentioned earlier, they're using algorithms in the judicial system. So what they do in the US is, they basically tried to decide whether a defendant awaiting trial is too dangerous to be released out in society. So they use an algorithm that tries to predict the probability that this defendant will reoffend if they're released in society. Also, as I mentioned, they're using algorithms as well to basically shortlist candidates for interviews. But I want to focus on the judicial system because it's more serious. What they found in the US after using these algorithms is that the algorithm was basically racist. So what they found was that for blacks who didn't end up reoffending once released, the model assigned a higher probability than whites who didn't reoffend. And the same applies as well with whites who did reoffend get a lower probability than blacks who actually did reoffend. So the society, the American society was saying, well, if they both reoffended, the fact that he's black or he's white, why should it matter? Why did the model assign a higher probability to him because of his race? And basically you get into very sensitive racial debates. Now, the bottom line is the model was assigning higher probabilities to the black community than to the whites. Now, there's a lot of technical detail here that I won't go into in this forum, but we can discuss after if you're interested. But bottom line is this, that with these algorithms, there's an inherent trade-off between the model being well-calibrated and the model being fair. You can't have both. And I'll explain what I mean. Well-calibrated means this, that if the model assigns, say, a 20% probability of reoffending for a particular group, then what actually happens is 20% of that group reoffend. That's a well-calibrated model. a fair model means that the average probabilities for one group should be roughly the same as the average probabilities for another group. So the average probabilities for the blacks should be roughly the same as the average probability for the whites, for it to be fair. Now, there's an elegant mathematical proof of this, but basically, and it's intuitive if you think about it, you can't have both a well-calibrated model and a fair model unless two scenarios where you could have the two. Number one, you've got perfect predictions. So the model perfectly predicts the probability for each person and the calibration's spot on, which is very, very unlikely because no model's perfect. The other scenario is if your two groups, whoever you're considering, whether it's males, females, blacks and whites, if the groups are balanced. So what I mean by that is that historically, blacks and whites reoffend at the exact same rate. If the two groups are balanced, then yeah, you could possibly get fairness and well-calibrated model at once. It gets more complicated as well if you think about it in multi-dimensionals. So for example, if I consider race and gender, so think of a matrix, black males, black females, what can I make it fair across all four groups, across the different dimensions? It gets quite complicated. Another complicating factor, if you think about it, is that the actual results of the model may not be what you're actually trying to measure. For example, what's this model trying to predict? It's trying to predict whether a person's going to re-offend or not. But if you think about it, that's not really what it's predicting. It's predicting whether this person is going to get arrested for re-offending or not. It's not about whether they're going to commit a crime or not. It's whether they're going to get caught doing it, right? Because that's your historical data. It's looking at people who got caught. So that means that white people could be committing just as much crime as blacks people, but blacks are getting caught more frequently. Maybe that's because blacks live in more policed areas, highly policed areas. So again, you've got to think about your input data coming in, your model, and the way you're using your results and your definition of the result. So all this gets very, very interesting and philosophical. And as I said, there's a lot of details here that I'm going to skim over, but just to give you a taste of the issues out there. So how do you deal with this? How do you deal with the fact that you can't have a well-calibrated model and a fair model? The only solution is that you have to treat this as a constrained optimization problem. You're always, in these circumstances, you're always optimizing. You're never perfecting. You can't perfect. Always optimizing. But some considerations to think about in order to ensure fairness. Firstly, your definition of fairness. Before building the model, define what's fair. And we'll get to that because it's very philosophical sometimes. What's fair to one person could be unfair to another person. Usually the natural suspect in unfairness is the training data, so your historical data. So you've got to look at that as well. You also got to consider that things change over time and the model may not take that into account. The model's looking backwards. Also, you may think about ignoring certain... So imagine, say, we're going to ignore race as a variable. We're going to ignore that in our model. But you've got other variables that correlate to race, where they live. If it's gender, you've got things that correlate to whether they're male or female. Do you ignore them as well? How far do you go in this? And I think the last point is the most important point. You've got to keep the human in the loop. You can't let these things run wild without having human intervention at each point to try to police these things. So now, before I kind of finish off, just a debate on fairness. And by the way, a point I wanted to make is that if our algorithms are based on our past data and our past history, and our world is not fair, how can we expect our algorithms to be fair if our algorithms are built on what's happening in our world, and we have unconscious biases, and we are unfair ourselves? It's very hard to get an algorithm that'll be fair. Some interesting questions around fairness. As I mentioned, one thing that's fair to one group could be unfair to another group. So it's very debatable, and it's up to perception. For example, you know, credit scores are a significant predictor of you having a motor claim on your motor insurance. Do you use that variable? Is it fair? Is it fair to charge someone who's going through maybe financial hardship a higher premium and make things worse? Is it fair not to? And make the rest subsidized. If women live longer than men, is it fair to charge them less for life insurance? Maybe if you're a woman, you'll say that's fair, but if you're a man, you'll say that's unfair. So it depends which group you're in. In certain communities, child abuse is very prevalent. So if you're going to build a model to predict child abuse, do you use, for example, race? Do you use whether they're Aboriginal or not, knowing maybe that in Aboriginal communities there's a higher rate of child abuse? Do you use that to save the child, or do you try to be fair and not use it? So it gets very, very philosophical, and you need to think very carefully about how you define fairness. Another question is fairness, the definition of fairness, the firm's call? Should firms decide what's fair, or should the regulator step in and tell us what's fair? So just a few questions to think about. Just to finish up before I hand over to Karanthi, our algorithmic risk framework, the three areas that I mentioned, you need to think about your input data, your modelling consideration, your implementation and monitoring. That's all underpinned by regulation and within a framework of fairness. And that's our proposed risk management framework, and I'll pass over to Karanthi.
Awesome. Thank you, Basim. Right. So Basim talked wonderfully about some of these aspects. I'm going to talk to you about some technical details. Data scientists have this habit of, you know, going with the flow when they have to talk anything technical, and I fall in the same category. But given that I'm talking to actuaries, I don't think I need to worry too much about constraining myself on what to speak and what not. Just from my understanding, how many life insurers are there in the room? Maybe by raise of hands. Wonderful. That's a decent number. We actually expected more, but maybe our algorithm was biased. So, to make this easier, to talk about all the examples, I'm going to start with a case study, a life insurance case study. And as we go through each stage of the algorithm building process, we'll see where the risks are, what kind of risks we would be seeing in each of those, and we'll discuss some examples. And we'll make this very interactive, so if you have some examples that you faced when you came across any of these, happy for you to share during the conversation itself rather than waiting until the end. So, the problem picking is the problem of application triage. So in life insurance, when an application comes in, or when many applications come in, it's natural for most of the applications to go through a medical underwriting process. Now, there's a trade-off here. Obviously, the payouts at the end of the application the payouts when there's a claim are much higher than the cost incurred for medical assessment. So it's natural for us to send all the applications for medical assessment and then determine how much premium is to be charged for those policies. Now, two things. One, this is costly, having the assessment done. And secondly, this is going to take some time. So if someone else is offering someone a policy within a few minutes or a few hours, and if the person doesn't have to wait for a few weeks to get the assessment done and then get the right premium, and if the premium is also not going to be significantly different, then probably they'll go with the other insurer. So lots of insurers in the US have already started doing this, and even in Australia, we started looking at triaging applications using algorithms. So the process is this. So we use a lot of internal and external data, some qualitative and quantitative inputs. We have algorithms which would provide risk scores. So these risk scores basically put applications into different risk buckets. So one bucket would be a relatively low risk group. So these are the individuals who wouldn't need any medical assessment. So they can be directly sent to underwriters for policy underwriting. And there will be other risk buckets which are probably higher risk. So they need like full medical underwriting. Now, what we'll do is we'll go through different stages of an algorithm building process, starting with input data, then we'll touch upon algorithm design, and then implementation and ongoing monitoring, and talk about some examples where we notice certain risks, and we'll give some examples, and what we need to do in order to tackle those risks. So, input data. There are a number of considerations, starting with availability. This is very important. So we need to choose data which is available at the time of implementing the algorithm. For example, if when an application comes in, a lot of data is collected in that already. Now, an underwriter, when he or she speaks with the applicant, they get more information, and that's also recorded in the application. Now, is it right to use all this data for building the algorithm? Maybe not. Because when we implement the algorithm, we might be implementing at the time when we receive the application first. And then we decide whether we should get more information, or is this good enough, we send to the underwriter, or is it good enough to send for medical assessment. Right? So we should be using data which is available at the time of implementing the algorithm. Now, things about there being bias in data. So this is a classical example. So insurance companies keep changing questions on the application every now and then. So there could be a question where it asks, do you smoke? Options could be yes or no. And then there could be another question which says, how often do you smoke? So this might be in a different year, in a different application. And the options could be very rarely, or very frequently, or something in between, things like that. Now, let's say I smoke on a quarterly basis. I guess that's not even a term. Maybe once every quarter, that very infrequently, let's say. And if I see a question, how often do you smoke? And if I see an option, very rarely, maybe I'll put into that. But if they're only yes or no, I don't want to identify myself with people who smoke frequently. So I would definitely be saying no. So now when we combine this data, so how do we treat each of these? And how do we combine the data set to have a consistent base? And by the way, I don't smoke at all, just in case any of you are wondering. Now, sorry. So there are other considerations as well in terms of data transformation. Quality assessment, this is very important. We've seen people having handwritten notes, people using scanned copies to save their data sets. Now, all of this can be saved in an Excel form using optical character recognition techniques and all those things. But obviously, there's going to be issues with data quality. Now, I have a beautiful handwriting, so even a very poor algorithm can detect what I wrote and could put it in an Excel format or something. But no offense to doctors in the room, but I could never understand what a doctor writes in my prescription slip, ever. So it's really hard to get everything transcribed into an Excel form or something that can be used directly by algorithms. So there are going to be lots of data quality issues. So it's a question of how we treat them. Do we consider fields if they are not good enough? Or do we have some alternate measures, maybe imputing some of those missing values? Or treating some outliers, so things like this. So these are all considerations that we should look at even before we proceed to building the algorithm. So this usually takes about 40 to 50% of our work, even before we proceed to building an algorithm. That's only an estimate. In some cases, it could be even more. Now, there's an example. I mean, this is about there being bias in data where certain occupations are more biased towards males and certain occupations being more biased towards females. Bassam already stole my thunder by taking this example, so I won't go through that. So there are a few questions. I haven't put together the entire list of questions we have. I just pulled in a few sample questions for our discussion. So a lot of questions need to be answered. So are we taking call on, let's say, fields that are being manually created? So in the application process, so there could be certain questions. And person would look at that, okay, the person said A, B, C, so definitely D should also be ticked in, and they would just tick it. So that is something that would be captured in the data set. But when we implement the models, these manually created fields might not be available at that time. So we need to be careful to understand the source of truth and take a call on whether those fields should be included or not. Now, going to algorithm design, obviously, choice of model, model complexity, and resources, these are very important. Let's say we're talking about the same underwriting example. Now, the model is supposed to give risk scores. So when it says that this application is highly risky, that they need to go through medical assessment, it should also say why. Is it because they had some knee surgery in the past? Or is it because they had a heart attack or a heart surgery or something? So it has to give the reasons also. So the model needs to be interpretable. At the same time, talking about accuracy, so I could build a deep neural network with 20 layers where all my parameters are being saved in 100 TB server space and it will take about a week to run and give me results. Is that useful? Maybe it's giving me 75 or 80% accuracy. But I can roughly get about very similar accuracy if I build a GLM model which will give me good results, which is interpretable, it's scalable, and it's very quick to implement also. So it's a trade-off between different factors. So predictive accuracy. So maybe we can compromise a bit on that to ensure that the models are interpretable, simple, even scalable. Speed, in this case, we don't need results in just a second or two. It's okay even if the model takes a few minutes or an hour to get the results, right? So this is a trade-off between various factors, and based on this, the type of algorithm can be decided. This is only for our interpretation, not something that we considered when we used before. So here's an example. So very often I see people using p-values to say whether the variables in the model are significant or not. Now, I'm not a big fan of p-values. I stopped using p-values long ago for one simple reason. When I studied what p-values are, I understood wrongly what they are. So Fisher, when he came up with these p-values, he used some exactors to basically identify bad data from different observations and reject them. So that's where he first came up with these p-values. But now we're using them in different circumstances, different scenarios. And let me give you this example. So what I did is I randomly simulated 20,000 observations, all from normal distribution, completely random. I've got about 100 predictive variables, all are random again, and one dependent variable, the target variable, which is also random. So there are no correlations between any of these variables. The correlations are all less than 0.01%, so like really small, insignificant. So ideally, when I build my model, my predictive variable should not explain my dependent variable at all, right? So here's what I did. I built a simple regression model on that. And I noticed the three variables came out to be significant. When I say significant, at 5% level of significance for p-values, they came out to be significant. So if I use those variables to create my model and test it on the test data set, that's how the predictions look like. On the x-axis, I have the actual values, and on the y-axis, I have the predicted values. It's completely random, beautiful circle. I mean, not a complete circle, but a close approximation. So where was I wrong? So when I say p-values, I'm looking at 5% level of significance. There's 5% chance that my inferences could be wrong. So if I have 100 variables, then on an average, 5 of my variables will be significant. So that's what a p-value with a 5% level of significance means. So does that mean they're significant? Maybe not. There isn't sufficient evidence to say that they are insignificant or otherwise. So it's the actual understanding of what p-values mean that's important. That's actually kind of lost, you know, over time. And we keep using p-values in our analysis. And more recently, I mean, not so recently, maybe a couple of years ago, the American Statistical Association started rejecting all PhD theses which use p-values to come up with their, you know, final results. Yeah, so a few questions that we need to look at. So the most important one for testing an algorithm is, did we validate the algorithm properly? Now, it's a habit. What we normally study in textbooks and everywhere is if you have a modeling data set, randomly split it into, say, 70% training, 30% testing, build the model on your trained data set, test it on your test data set, which is good, gold standard, no doubt. But all these models are built on current data, and they will be tested on future data. So maybe in some scenarios, and more suitable form of splitting data set would be, we build the models on 3 years of data, let's say, and test it on the more recent 1 year, because past is never a true reflection of future. So unless we make sure that models built on past data work well on future data, we won't have enough confidence to say that the models would work on any future data that would come in, right? So there are a number of other considerations also. And another important one is data scientists write codes in, say, SAS or R or Python, any of these programming languages. So we need to have proper checks in place to ensure that the courts are giving out results exactly the way we want. Now, I'm always intrigued by fancy and new things that come in. So if someone comes up with a really fancy package which can reduce the length of my code by one line and increase speed by 1 minute, I'll use that because I find it fancy. But they may not give the same results that we want, and we may not be interpreting those results accurately. So it's always important to have the codes and everything properly reviewed before things are implemented. So these are some nitty-gritties. I won't get into too much detail of that. Implementation ongoing monitoring. Now, this is my favorite problem. So when we implemented this application triage process, we faced one problem which took us 2 days to troubleshoot and resolve. And you'll find this really funny. So the problem was we built all the codes on a different server, and we got the risk scores. Now we are testing the models on a different data set on a platform where the algorithms are being implemented. So this whole platform is tied up with the actual application process. So as and when the applications come in, the models will be running in the background and will generate the risk score. So that was the idea. But we built the models by taking the data set out on a separate server. Now, what happened was when we are comparing the results, we are getting different results. Not too different, but definitely there are some differences. And we couldn't figure out where the differences are because most values seem to be fine. We couldn't see any errors. And then we found the problem. The problem was with rounding of decimal places. So the server we used, it was taking only up to 6 decimals, but the platform you're looking at, it has no limit. I mean, it can have more decimal places. So there are some differences which are adding up with oversteps, and they're just giving like different risk groups. So we need to be conscious about what platform we're using to build the models and where we are implementing them. So these are some really, really finer details that we don't pay much attention to when we build the model, but we might run into plenty of issues when we implement the models. Other things are things like feedback loops or correction cascades, things like that. So where the outputs of one model might be used as inputs for another model. So if there is something wrong with the first model, it's giving a different results, everything from that step will be wrong. So we need steps to ensure that we're properly testing everything before we say that we're doing a full implementation. Ongoing monitoring. So this is a simpler one. Over time, model's performance keeps deteriorating. Could be because of different reasons. The input data might be changing, or the business might be implementing and they are seeing better results. So obviously, experience is going towards better. So we need ongoing monitoring process in place to ensure. So a few questions that we need to look at. Again, this is only a sample list of questions, looking at feedback loops or correction cascades and all those things. So I'll give an example here. So I won't say which line of business, but one of the underwriting problems. So one of the variables in the model was number of installments. So initially, the company was allowing for up to 10 installments, people to pay their premiums in 10 installments. Now, that's what we used in the model. So the model was giving good results. Everything was good. They used for 1 year. And then there were some business decisions made that they'll no longer allow 10 installments. They'll only allow up to 6 installments. So now the input data itself is changing. We no longer see values 7, 8, 9, and 10. So obviously the model parameters, so the model results, they are shifting towards different risk scores, and we are not seeing the results that we wanted to see. So the problem here was that when certain business decisions are being made, we're not able to link them to this particular model and say that, you know, this is also being affected. So if you're making this decision, we need to inform this team which maintains this model to update the model. So if all these interlinks and all these are not established, this framework is not created, then we would run into all these problems, right? So, yeah, that kind of brings this to an end. A very abrupt ending, but we have some time for questions, I guess.
Yeah.
thank you very much. That was really interesting. If you have questions, could you please use that microphone if it's working, or this one if it's not, and state your name, because the session will be recorded. So who would like to ask the first question of the guys? Thank you.
Hi, I'm David Grundy. I'm curious, I think this is probably more for Bassem, about whether there's any work done on being able to quantify the risk of getting one of these algorithms quite wrong. So we see a few cases, the ones you mentioned have been fairly prominent in the news. There must be a lot of things that go wrong that we don't see. Maybe businesses suffer from that, we don't know about it. Is there any hope of quantifying the chance and the severity? I'm thinking about this from modelling of risk. I mean, I work in Solvency II area sometimes for the company I work for in Hong Kong, and we need to be able to quantify the operational risk component of this.
So it's really hard to quantify this because it's hard to say that these are the 10 different types of risks which would be involved in this process. So this is what each of them would result in. So it's tough to quantify the overall risk, but then it's comparatively easier to come up with a range, saying that if we identify different types of risks, and if we're able to benchmark the estimated risk associated with each of those, then it's possible to come up with a range. But thanks for asking that question. This is a really useful input. So if we can quantify the estimated severity of certain risks, so that would be fantastic. Yeah. Do you want to add anything?
I mean, I'd say probably from what I've seen, nothing more than the usual kind of way they do operational risk, which, as Corinthy mentioned, is kind of identify different risks and give estimates for the severity. But there's been nothing, and I think it gets complicated with algorithmic risks, as I said. Often it's a black box. Often it's hard to unlock and kind of pick out the different segments and how different things could go wrong and the severity. So it's tough. It's a tough problem. Yeah, it hasn't been cracked yet. But I think the first step is just kind of awareness of the risk, having a governance framework around it. And I think that will go a long way, because currently we're, there's nothing really. Think about it. There's no standards for algorithmic risk at all. So I think that I see that as a first step, and I think we will develop techniques in future. Yeah.
Is there any other questions at all? Thank you. I'm not sure that mic's working, so I'll give you this one.
This might be a little flippant to start with, but Bassem, you might like this. Football predictions, the World Cup, for instance. Did you write any algorithms to try to predict the last World Cup? And I've got a couple of follow-ups. I'll be quick, everyone. Sorry. Yes, no.
I haven't personally, no.
Okay. How did you feel about the people that did being beaten by an octopus?
I was going to say that. We relied on octopus.
Yeah, I can explain it. We can all explain why the octopus got beaten. But being more serious, what do you do when actually an algorithm isn't working, but you've got management wedded to it because it saved money, they've sacked people or moved people on because they think they're going to save? How do you unravel all that if you find it isn't working after a certain time?
Good question.
Have you ever had to go through that with explaining with your clients, for instance?
I mean, always. I think there's often a blind faith in algorithms, and they kind of say, look, it's the model. I mean, the model said it. How can it be wrong? But yeah, I think it's an education piece. Explaining, as another famous quote goes, you know, all models are wrong, some are useful. So I think it's a very important education piece to educate your clients and the people using the model that this is not gospel. This isn't, you know, as I mentioned, models are black and white. They're estimates at the end of the day. It's a probability. Whereas, you know, the real world's a lot more complex. There are infinite variables in the real world that are very hard to capture in one model. So definitely I think it's education piece. And I think part of the algorithmic risk is that people have blind faith in algorithms. That's a major part of the risk, and that people aren't even aware that there's a risk. They think that...
Yeah. I just wanted to add a point there. So we initially had a slide on governance, a governance model on how to ensure that what if certain things go wrong, who should be notified and how should they be treated. So when the models are implemented, it's very important to educate everybody who will be using those models on what could go wrong, what are some potential risks that they might see. over time and what they need to do when they see such issues. So, yeah.
Thank you all very much indeed. We've run out of time. If you could thank the guys in the normal way. Thank you very much indeed.